Welcome to Mobility Now, the podcast that looks at mobility technology sitting at the edge of today, but the center of tomorrow. I'm your host, Amit Mehta, Head of Innovation at Silicon Valley Lab, an advanced research division of North American Lighting, a subsidiary of the Koito Group, the world's leading tier one supplier of exterior automotive lighting.
I'm your co-host, Dan Davies, Innovation Manager at Silicon Valley Lab. Autonomous vehicles and other mobility technologies have the potential to reduce road fatalities, reduce congestion, and change the way we experience traveling. Mobility Now interviews key players from startups and industry leaders developing these mobility technologies.
Mobility Now is for people new to the industry, students wanting to enter the industry, and others in the industry that would like to keep up on trends surrounding mobility. So Dan, I know I always discuss some macro effects of you living in San Francisco and how it's going in San Francisco.
Yeah.
And one trend I've noticed is the migration out of San Francisco to other areas in the country. Have you noticed this as well?
Yeah, a lot of news articles about that lately, right? I've noticed a lot of people moving. There are more moving trucks around. My neighborhood, Nob Hill, is the neighborhood with the most people moving out. And my neighbors actually moved out a couple of months ago. So it was sad to see them go.
Wow.
Yeah. I read also that a lot of the people are moving out of San Francisco, but to other areas in the Bay. And I thought that was interesting to read about. I think that that's happening because the Bay Area is still an attractive place for people to live, especially if you're in technology or venture capital. Because the Bay is still a hub for innovation, right? Last year, of the $156 billion in VC funding in the US, 22% of that came from the Bay Area.
That's an amazing stat. Wow.
Yeah, that's a lot, right? And then 40% of that went back to Bay Area companies.
Incredible.
So there's this cycle going on of technology developers attracting venture capital and venture capital in turn attracting technology developers. And in the Bay, innovation is generating more innovation. And I think as long as that cycle continues, it's still going to be a place that people will want to live.
That's amazing, Dan. I can see why innovation follows funding and funding follows innovation, right? I think this is a great segue to introduce our next guest, founding member and managing director of Toyota AI Ventures, Jim Adler. Very excited to have you here today, Jim, and really looking forward to this discussion.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Great. Let's get started because I think you have a lot of insight and our audience members would really like to learn from you. So first, I'd like to know more about you. Tell us your journey and how you got here.
It was definitely nonlinear. I started my career as a rocket engineer working for what's now Lockheed Martin, launching boosters and upper stages. I was a rocket engineer, not a rocket scientist. Rocket scientists are found primarily at the blackboard and at the computer running MATLAB simulations. Rocket engineers are found at whiteboards and in labs and at launch sites. So I was doing avionics systems, control systems, gimbaling systems for Atlas and Centaur, Titan, Centaur, booster upper stage combinations, as well as early work in the space station Freedom many, many years ago.
Incredible.
It was a great time. I was an electrical engineer there was nothing more fun than being in the space industry at the time. But I had this kind of this itch for doing more entrepreneurial things. Big companies are big companies. They just don't move at the speed of startups. And I just had this this itch to go do something on my own. And I did a bunch of entrepreneurial endeavors during the subsequent 20 years or so. Some pretty successful, others horrifically failed. You learn and profit from you learn from the failures and you profit from the successes,
I think, in equal measure.
But I just found myself continually curious and ambitious. And so found myself in the voting industry for a while. I did my graduate work in digital signal processing and cryptography. So voting systems, as we've just recently learned, are are tough things to audit, especially given secret ballots, perfect for cryptographic solution. Right. So we did some early blockchain work in the early 2000s around voting systems, and understood the privacy implications of voting, got deeply enmeshed in the privacy community. The company ultimately, a product was sold, and then the company sold into a public records company where I joined as the vice president of data systems, so ran the data science team, and I was also chief privacy officer there. So like accidentally found myself dropping into a privacy officer role for a while, and then jumped back into a startup doing scale out data analytics. That we sold that company to Microsoft in 2015. And then I tend to do a startup and then I rest, and then I do a startup and then I rest. And mostly the rest is an emotional rest because startups can be quite taxing.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And my latest rest was at Toyota after we sold the company to Microsoft. And I was sort of itching to do another startup after spending some time at Toyota Research Institute. But Toyota was looking to start a venture fund, and I was curious about how Toyota was going to run that fund, having raised tens of millions of dollars in my career over the years, taking venture money from institutional VCs and corporate VCs. I had some very hard opinions on what made a good investor and a bad investor, and I was really determined to make sure that my opinions were known while I was on the Toyota payroll. And so I did, and ran those ideas up the chain. And it was important that Toyota understood the dynamics of what I felt a successful venture effort would look like, what the challenges were and what the benefits were. And we got approval for that first fund in July, 2017. Of $100 million, the first Toyota AI Ventures fund, and have been building on it ever since.
Wow. Great. Yeah, what a wide variety of different things you've
absolutely
done, Jim,
amazing.
From space to blockchain, privacy, all things that are still relevant today. So really interesting.
Not by design.
Yeah, so I wanted to learn a little bit more about Toyota AI Ventures today. Can you tell me a bit about the organization and what's your mission?
Yeah, so Toyota AI Ventures' mission is really to explore what might be next for Toyota. So we are an early stage fund. So we do seed and series A investments in AI, obviously it's in our name, but also autonomy, mobility, robotics, data, cloud technologies, really looking for really where Toyota might go next. It's a very dynamic world. Startups are, I firmly believe, experiments in the marketplace, and it's a great place to understand what's coming. And so if you understand Toyota's history, Toyota actually is quite entrepreneurial. I mean, Toyota started as an industrial textile company making looms for weaving fabric. And Toyota pivoted to cars in the 1930s, and that pivot worked out pretty well. And so Toyota does still maintain that sort of entrepreneurial juice, which I really didn't really discover till I got here in 2016. And it really has informed our mission and our thesis. You really don't understand what's coming next until you get really up close and personal with it. And so, our mission is really to get up close and personal with the best and brightest and most innovative startup teams on the planet and get a front row seat to what they're bringing to market and the experiments that they're running.
Yeah, very cool. An amazing pivot, right? From making looms in the textile industry to becoming one of the biggest automobile manufacturers. So really great. I was looking at the Toyota AI Ventures website and learning a bit about your vision, and it looking at your portfolio, it's really a wide gamut of different technologies. It looks like you're looking at achieving for the future a multimodal mobility ecosystem across land, air, and sea, really everything. And it seems like it's focusing quite a bit on the user experience, providing a seamless experience across these different modes of transportation. I noticed also that there's a focus on the autonomy aspect, that's sort of behind the scenes that maybe the user doesn't see, with maybe sensing, perception, and those kinds of autonomous vehicle technologies. And also image recognition or object recognition, right? Giving those vehicles the ability to know what's going on around them. Can you share maybe some examples of companies in your portfolio that really play into this overall vision of multimodal mobility?
Yeah, sure. So I know when you say it that way, it sounds like there's not much method to the madness. What we like, the way we like to think about it is, there is a set of technologies that are continuing to evolve and improve. And with the maturation of those technologies, comes new business models or new ways to bring that technology to people's lives. I mean, mm-hmm. we talked about Toyota's roots as an entrepreneurial enterprise. The capability that Toyota has is understanding how machines can amplify the human experience. Okay. You know, you hit the accelerator in a Lexus LC500 or a Toyota Supra and man, you feel amplified. And it's incredibly exhilarating. And we think that the technologies around autonomy and mobility are similarly going to continue to amplify the human experience. So if you look at our investments in mobility and autonomy, I think those certainly make some sense, but those technologies are also applicable to what we're doing in industrial automation and logistics or smart and connected cities. Moving people around has many modes, whether it's in the air or on land or on the seas. People need to move around, and we're going to see this unbundling of mobility continuing. In fact, you see that in all modes. There's a great Jim Clark quote that says, "You know, the only way to." Make money. I think it might be Jim Barksdale. The only way to make money is to bundle or unbundle. That's the only two ways to make money. And so, the personally owned vehicle for 100 years has been the dominant business model for mobility, but that business model is being unbundled. And that's, I think, to the benefit of users, to the benefit of consumers. And so you're seeing that with certainly with all the micro mobility modes that are making their way into the mobility landscape. We have an investment in Revel that has made their stake in mopeds, all electric moped rentals by the minute, by the hour, by the day. But they've also just yesterday announced electric infrastructure that they're laying out across some of their markets. So we're starting to see startups really bring battery electric mobility modes to the market. And you'll continue to see that. On the other side of the equation is autonomy. So you're seeing, of course, we're sort of at the trough of the hype cycle on autonomy in many respects.
Yeah.
But you know that never worries me. Because it's a well-worn trajectory. We all know there's a hype and overhype, which we can get into it. But I think hype is a good thing because it draws in capital, it draws in talent to actually run these experiments and mature these technologies. And then, of course, things get a little overheated. But being an old control systems engineer, I know that underdamped systems are also the most responsive. And they usually settle in, you know, to a steady state as long as they don't go unstable. So it's not a bad thing. And so when you look at the technology stack, whether it be at the very top sensors and then perception underneath that or prediction underneath that to planning to actuation, there's innovations happening all up and down that stack. And of course, that stack is applicable to cars and other autonomous vehicles, but it's also equally applicable to robotics, right? In many respects, an autonomous car is just a really, really big wheeled robot.
That's right.
From a technology perspective, from a software perspective. So if you look at our portfolio through the lens of mobility for consumers and the technology that's driving autonomy, it kind of makes a lot more sense than if you just look at the portfolio. It sort of seems rather scattered, but a lot of the technologies are quite complementary. For example, when you look at one of our companies that does planning, really fast path planning, they can do that path planning to move cars around lanes. And the company I'm talking about is Real Time Robotics. Or you can use that path planning to make sure that robots can cooperate and not collide, or keep humans safe in the same workspace. So a lot of these technologies, although the application may seem very different, the underlying technology is quite common.
That was great, Jim. You talked a little bit about the method to madness and how you invest in startups, and also your accidental entrepreneurial roles and the entrepreneurial juice that you bring and Toyota really brings to the mobility marketplace. But one thing I'd like to understand is, in the initial startup evaluation phase, what are the three criteria you use to decide which startups you want to look further into?
Well, the way we look at any startup is like any institutional venture capitalist. And the reason for that is really fundamental. I think most corporate venture capitalists get this exactly backwards. We look at a company first financially and then strategically. There's a great Rick Mears quote, who's a great race car driver, that says, to finish first, you must first finish, which means that if a startup is going to finish first, they better first finish the race. They better be strong enough. They better have enough financing to win, at least to finish. And I think so VCs have been really dogmatically focused on finding great teams, great go-to-market, getting the timing right, understanding teams and technology and business models and market readiness, so that these companies can continue to raise financing, find early customers, and grow the business over time. And that is the lens with which we look at companies. We really don't look at these companies outside of the thesis, the investment thesis that I just described. We don't look at which companies might be a good fit for Toyota. Because I think when you do it that way, you're going to hobble your analysis around who's just going to win the market.
Makes sense. Yep.
And a lot of times business units will come to us and say, this company can't help Toyota at all. Why'd you invest in them? And my answer invariably is, they can't help you yet. Just wait a year, wait a couple of years.
Right.
These companies have a way of surprising you, and I don't have to win you over in the first meeting. The company needs to win you over the next several years. And when you invest early stage, I like to say early stage venture capital is like a telescope into the future. And late stage venture capital is much more like a magnifying glass or a microscope into the future, much tighter window.
Oh, cool.
And so we need to make sure that these companies live long enough to be in the future. And that's what VC is really good for. So we really have first and foremost a financial return over strategic return focus. And we are organized that way. And I could talk about how we're organized to kind of meet that mission and strategy.
Yeah, please. We would love to hear
that. So I'm a big believer in, you know, where you stand is determined by where you sit in the organization. So when we were laying out, like, how should we be organized? Yes, it was very clear we should be organized as a tight, small venture capital organization. The other thing that occurred to me a few years ago is finding and closing good venture capital deals, finding great startups and investing them in them is not unlike my past as an entrepreneur selling enterprise software. What do I mean by that? Well, any enterprise software company has this funnel of marketing that tries to find great prospects, a sales team that closes those prospects, and a post-close support team that supports those customers. And if you think for a moment who the customer is in a venture capital fund, too many corporates believe that the parent corporation is the customer. No, they're not the customer. The startup is the customer. Okay, because you want to attract the best customers, the best startups. So if you think that the startup is your customer, then it's very clear. Then you have a marketing team that works on promoting the fund, the firm, finding the best startups. That's the marketing effort. The deals team, the investment team, is the sales team. Their job is to ferret out all those, all that inbound that the marketing team brought, close them into really good deals. And we do about 10 deals or so a year, about 1% of the deals we see, roughly. And then once you have a deal, an investment closed, they become part of our portfolio. Well, what do you do with customers after you've sold them? You support them. So we have a post-deal support team, and their only job is to make this startup successful. And if that success means connecting them to Toyota, and it usually does, given that Toyota is worldwide, has a huge network and 370,000 employees. For many of our companies, that means a connection with Toyota, which dovetails perfectly with the strategic aspect of what the fund is from a corporate perspective. Now we have really strong companies that are leading their markets in their innovative and disruptive technologies and business models. And now we can connect them to Toyota, so Toyota business units can get a clear understanding of how that company could be a supplier to Toyota, could be a partner, could be a future investment, and it really works out quite well.
That's a lot of information. I want to summarize a couple of things for the audience. Number one is, as you said, teams, tech, and business model. That's what you're looking for in a startup, and then you're looking at the market disruption that they could cause. One thing, James, that you told us that I didn't even know, and I didn't even realize to look at like this, is the startup is the customer. And I've never thought to look at something like that. And that's incredible. It's really eye-opening. I appreciate that advice.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
One point I'll make before we move on this, and this gets a little bit more color on how we evaluate from a VC financial perspective. There's really three pieces to this puzzle. One is what the company can control, which is the team, the technology, the product, the business model, the go-to-market. The second is the market itself. And is it big enough? Is it broken? And is it ready to be disrupted and fixed? Some markets are big and broken, but they're not ready to be fixed. Government markets tend to fall in that category. Actually, automotive 20 years ago, 10, 20 years ago, used to be in that bucket. Big and broken, but maybe not ready for innovation. I think that's changed over the last 10 years. And then finally, the last and least important is the financing risk and the price, the valuation. Those kinds of details need to be right as well. But that's really the lens with which we look at the company, sort of in a 60-30-10 proportions, you know, weighted to the company itself, the market, and the financing.
Thank you. I think that's a good end off to segue into our next question, because as you said, there's a market for different sensors, which we specifically are looking at in our portfolio as well. But we've seen five LiDAR companies that have gone public through SPACs or are on the verge of going public through a SPAC. And there's a lot of investor interest in LiDAR. And even we at NAL and Koito have done our due diligence on the industry and made an investment of our own. We've seen that Toyota AI Ventures also invested in a LiDAR company that has exited now, Blackmore, which was working on 1515 LiDAR, which before it was cool. So TAIV also has radar and computer vision in its portfolio, which you described earlier. Can you talk about your investment approach to sensors? Because it's more of a hardware capital intensive endeavor that you put a lot of money in and hope something comes out later on. And if L5 full autonomy is achieved using camera radar only, is that pretty much the end of LiDAR?
Well, it's a great question. And it's the question that the marketplace is dynamically computing on right now. And I'll take it as a compliment that we were looking at FMCW frequency modulated continuous wave LIDAR before it was cool. And the guys at Blackmore, great team up out of Montana that were bought by Aurora, one of the leading autonomous vehicle companies. I think that you're going to see certain use cases that are great for LIDAR, for sure. I don't subscribe to the religion around it's going to be all LIDAR, it's going to be all camera, or it's all going to be LIDAR or camera radar. Mm-hmm. I think certain use cases are going to lend themselves to other to certain solutions. For example, it might, until LIDAR price points come down significantly, it's going to be tough to put a LIDAR on a personally owned vehicle for, say, ADAS applications. There's no room in the BOM costs for an expensive LIDAR. For a high utilization, for a personally owned vehicle that's only driven 5% of the time. For a higher utilization vehicle, fleet vehicles or ride hail vehicles, sure, LIDAR could make some sense there, of course. But cameras are just way too ubiquitous and way too inexpensive for them not to be part of this equation. Right. And they have negatives too, right? I mean, data load is being probably the leading negative on cameras. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, radar is incredibly inexpensive, has some great applications for a velocity metrics estimation. Of course, the resolution isn't there, and radar is all weather, which is great because LIDAR is not. So, and camera is not in foggy conditions, for example. So you're going to see multiple modes, and you're going to see, I think, mixing and matching of different different sensors for different use cases, which I don't think is a bad thing. We are doing. Investing in this part of the stack because it is somewhat of a gatekeeper to autonomy. If you can do perception economically and effectively, it unlocks a lot of opportunity for the rest of the autonomy stack to deliver real value to customers. So we are investors in a high resolution radar company called MetaWave. We're invested in a chip company actually called Recogni, which is doing 1,000 tops at very, very low power, multi-channel inputs, camera, radar, LIDAR, and doing edge detection at incredible throughputs, as I said. So the perception side of the stack is going to be an area of focus, so to speak, for quite a while.
Very interesting. Great to learn about multimodal sensing and how all these different sensor modes are coming together to really improve perception. You also have the perception, I guess, the software side that's advancing. And I think as these technologies advance, it's really going to change the types of transportation that we have. ADAS is a great example of something that's really improved in leaps and bounds over the last, say, 10 years. And I think as it continues to improve, we'll start to see more autonomous vehicles, autonomous shuttles like May Mobility, also in your portfolio.
Yeah.
And maybe even flying cars, which was kind of becoming a more common topic lately. So I was wondering, what are you investing now that you think will come to fruition in the markets in the next, say, 5 to 7 years?
Like I said, we have our portfolio, we hope, is a telescope into the future. Mm-hmm. So if you look at our portfolio, you mentioned air taxis or aircraft that will be a growing mobility mode in the coming years. And we are really excited about Joby Aviation. We invested in 2017. Toyota Motor Corp took a much bigger position in January 2020, leading their $600 million round. And we're really excited about what Joby's doing. Amazing aircraft, great use case. Joben Beaver, the founder, has this great mission of saving 1 billion people 1 hour per day. And when I heard that back in 2017, I'm like, this is the guy I want to invest in. Yeah. This is a mission that will help humanity across the planet, make us more productive, and really deliver value to the marketplace. And this isn't just a cool aircraft. It is totally cool. But there's a use case that, I mean, think about it. You can't build more roads in urban centers. You can't go down. You can't build tunnels. As much as everybody wants to build tunnels, it is just too hard to build tunnels, folks. So the only place to go is up.
Yeah.
And that's why we made that investment.
That is so cool. I can't wait to ride one.
Yeah, it's coming. It's coming. And then, you know, there's some, you know, kind of obscure tech companies we've invested in, like Moodify. Moodify is innovating around software-defined scents, like scents, S-C-E-N-T-S, for your nose. Yeah. I've been a big fan of finding a company that actually brought the olfactory center of our brains into mobility, and just generally taking advantage of that sense. We're all about eyes and ears, but we really don't, the nose doesn't really get the respect it deserves.
Yeah.
And Moodify has been working on this for 10 years at a Weizmann Center in Israel. And it's amazing what they can do about, at very, very low concentrations, block out foul odors without masking them, help your well-being by maybe helping you to become more alert, which is very important when you think about drowsy driving, or calming you down if you're getting too anxious. So the olfactory center of the brain is incredibly powerful, and I think clearly underutilized. So we think in the next 5 to 7 years, you're going to see that mode really delivering value to people all over the world.
Maybe a calming effect to solve road rage too.
That would be cool. Yeah, that's one of the, again, if it senses your blood pressure rising, it just gives you a little bit of calming scent to calm you down a bit. And then we see a bunch of robotics as well. I know we didn't really talk about it a whole lot, but I think whether it's in the factory or even for consumer applications, one of the smart city investments we've made recently was in YPC Technologies, which is a robot kitchen that can turn out hundreds, if not thousands, of recipes and is really a marvel in having robots prepare food. I think one of the challenges, especially in this COVID world that we live now, is many of us are getting our meals delivered, but most of the value of that meal drops exponentially across the delivery time window. Yeah. So, and anybody who got a cold pizza delivered knows what I'm talking about.
I know.
So if you could make the food closer to the ultimate consuming customer, I think you'll have a much better experience, and I think that's sort of low hanging fruit, which that company's focused on. So it's really fascinating to me. I think what you're seeing is what I like to view as the Cambrian explosion of business models as the technology kind of passes through a threshold of maturity. And it's just so, I just have such a great job, right? As Warren Buffett said, he skips to work every day. I skip to work every day. It's a very small trip these days, right. but I still find myself skipping to work.
Wow, that was a lot of information. It's really great to have you on here. But before you leave, just as you said, unbundling and bundling, I think you're unbundling mobility and bundling it back together and putting the entire automotive industry into something that's packageable for the future, for people who need it. as we move into the future, into mobility. So finally, I think asking you right now, if you have any advice for any new grads that are coming into the mobility space, specifically that those who want to get involved in the investor of mobility space, for example, that'd be great if you could share that information.
Yeah. I mean, given the fact that I was an accidental chief privacy officer, I was an accidental entrepreneur, and I'm an accidental venture capitalist, my advice would be don't plan it out too closely. You know, find a core competency, really learn deeply. Mark Sister has this, he's a VC at Upfront Capital. He's this great quip around there is time to learn and there's time to earn. And for young folks, don't focus on earning, focus on learning. You want to kind of oscillate between specialist and generalist. My instinct has always been toward generalist. I have a bit of ADD, right? I get very impatient. Finding myself too long in an industry, clearly, if you look at my career, right? So I've oscillated, but you have to go deep enough to be competent, right? You can't just skim on the surface. These industries, these technologies, they're too demanding, and they demand a level of seriousness and study. So for new grads, learn something and learn deep. But as an investor, you got to have some level of generality. You got to have some kind of systems approach to the world. I spent my formative career with control systems. And so I've noticed and I use system theory for business all the time. I do impulse response tests on all kinds of stuff. I remember when I was at a company, we were trying to figure out what screen would result in more clicks, right? Your classic A/B test for a website.
Right.
And people would think, hey, we just have to change a color or change these words. I said, how do you know? What kind of system are you dealing with? Are you dealing with a very sluggish system or are you dealing with a very fast acting system? Are you going to hit this thing? Are you going to hit a battleship with a tap hammer? Are you going to hit a skateboard with a sledgehammer? Which one is it? And you don't know. You don't know going in. And these assumptions, you got to sort of stand back and question yourself, your colleagues, in always in a respectful way, right? Always be the happy warrior. But you want to find that curiosity to go deep enough to be competent and relevant, but then general enough to find new opportunities. It's sort of that the explore-exploit trade-off, right? You want to exploit what you know, but you want to have the curiosity to explore. And if there's any watchword, at least of my career, and this is only one data point, so be very careful about one data point, trying to find the balance between those two extremes. And good things happen when you do.
Right. Well, thank you very much for being on Mobility Now. Really appreciate all the insight. And I think our audience will get a lot of information about how you're approaching mobility and how your venture fund is approaching mobility. And being associated with one of the biggest automaker in the world gives a lot of perspective to a lot of people out there. So we really appreciate it, Jim.
Thank you.
Dan, thanks so much. This has really been a pleasure. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Thank you.